This is a CBC podcast. Uncommon perspectives, unexpected ideas. Host Perdita Felician gives you sports stories like you've never heard them before. Frank and funny conversations with athletes. Personal takes on hockey night nostalgia. A minivan full of tales about families at play. Off Guard, CBC's latest original podcast. None of the scores, all of the time. Go to cbc.ca/offguard to subscribe.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark from CBC Radio. This time, the top 100 CEOs in Canada earn 193 times as much as the average industrial worker here. Think of what a company could do with all that dosh. Time to fire the CEO.
Everyone is free to make any kind of decision at any moment in time if the decision is small enough. For example, buying a popcorn machine for the office. Just do it.
Inside one company that got rid of their CEO. And have you always wanted to play an instrument? Is there a musician inside you just dying to get out? Well, now maybe technology can help.
It's more accessible in a really big way. So, you know, you don't have to have a degree in music technology to kind of get started. Just some enthusiasm.
First up, though, can a machine tell if I'm being mean to you? On Spark.
The future is coming.
The future is coming.
The future is coming.
The future is coming.
Arrive intact.
Arrive intact.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
Trolls. They used to guard bridges. Now they burn them, at least online. Online hatred is a painful reminder of the politically and socially divided world we live in. To see how nasty some people can be, you only have to visit the comments section of a newspaper or scroll through a Twitter feed. And right now, weeding out those trollish remarks is a very difficult job. So, is it something we can delegate to AI? Can a machine learn to tell the difference between constructive criticism and outright hatred? This is what Google has set out to do with its new platform called Perspective. Google's partnered with Wikipedia, The New York Times, and some other media companies. The goal is to help them weed out offensive comments on their websites. It's also released the platform publicly so anyone can try it out by typing in a sentence and having it scored in terms of its toxicity. So let's give it a whirl, shall we? Women should not be on the radio. Toxicity score, 10% toxic. How about this? Spark sucks. 94% toxic. Okay, that's right. Let's try one more. Spark is f***ing awesome. 94% toxic? Well, you know, my initial research would seem to suggest that this thing needs some work, and I'm not alone in that conclusion.
Am I allowed to swear on this show?
That's David Auerbach. He's a former Google software engineer who now writes for the MIT Technology Review. He recently put Perspective through its paces. He has some thoughts on why it seems to have such a hard time discerning the context of a sentence and whether the arrangement of words in it constitutes something offensive. So it seems like it gets stuck on some words that don't in of themselves mean anything hateful. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, it does seem that it's attuned to certain words being just inflammatory in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. Like I put, for example, the phrase garbage truck is 78% toxic. This is a scale from 0 to 100. So garbage truck on its own somehow manages a very, very high toxicity score. Mm. And presumably it's because of the word garbage, but that word in and of itself is a word that has many, many contexts, only some of them, you know, toxic.
Sure.
But this is where AI tends to fall down, especially AI that's trying to analyze human language, which is that it's not good at deriving greater context and semantics. So instead, it tends to match more on just, you know, the words and phrases being used. So for example, if I say Hitler was an anti-Semite, that's 70% toxic on its own simply by using the words Hitler and anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I say Jews are human, that's 72% toxic.
Wow, this is confusing and difficult. So what can you tell me about the way that Google engineers who worked on Perspective designed it?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, the details of it haven't quite been released to the public. We know that they're using some form of machine learning. And you know, Google has had some amazing successes in machine learning lately regarding, you know, beating humans at Go, which is something that people did not expect to happen for some time. And sort of their deep learning approach to image identification and learning to recognize faces, learning to recognize particular types of features like cats or things like that. But, you know, human language is something of a different area because it's less of a localized problem. It's something where in order to understand, you know, a fragment of human language, you have to have a pretty good grasp of a huge amount of the language in question. And that is not a problem that's currently been solved. Broadly speaking, what they have is a machine learning network that is trained on a bunch of examples. Mm-hmm. They feed it a bunch of comments that are identified as toxic or not toxic. And it attempts to learn patterns in that data that it then applies to match against these other comments. But the patterns are not ones of human meaning or human intent. They're patterns that are at the surface level of the data, you know, which words are being used, what phrasings are being used. And I think, as the examples I gave show, that's just not quite enough to judge toxicity in any sort of complex contextual way.
But so, like a lot of machine learning today, it's really, as you say, it's relying on these huge data sets and looking for correlations. Is it likely to improve as it gets more examples and more feedback about what's actually toxic and what's not?
I think you will see incremental improvements. The problem is that the type of patterns it's matching on, it won't be getting feedback on because that it needs to match on. Because the difference between, you know, if you use the wrong words, it's going to have very little ability to figure out that you're using the words in a non-toxic way. So while specific usages, specific phrasings may get bumped up or bumped down, there will still be the greater problem that if you're, say, quoting something.
Right. And so maybe there's no way for them to know, am I saying, I hate David Auerbach, or somebody told me that I hate David. You know what I mean? There's no way for it to parse out those differences?
It's a question of degree. If you look at the problem of how much can you learn about a given phrase without actually understanding the phrase, without actually knowing what it refers to, what it means, figuring out just from the words and the phrasings whether it's toxic or not, you can imagine that there's only so far you can get and that you aren't going to be able to match human performance. And I think that's what, you know, that's the goal they're aiming at. Can we match human performance to identify whether something is toxic or not? And in terms of something like facial recognition, determining whether, say, two faces are the same or not, computers have come close, you know, or even matched human performance. But in terms of identifying toxic comments, I think we're a long way off precisely because they don't have that understanding that humans have of the greater context of what words can mean in different environments.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there something in particular to do with language where, you know, it's just so nuanced about what we mean when we say, I effing love you, man, right?
Not just nuanced, but also variable. Words have so many different variations, you know, that every day, you know, language isn't a fixed target, as we know. New usages are coming into play all the time. People, you know, disinterested used to not mean uninterested, and now it does. So the question is even, you know, how are you even going to train an AI to keep up with this? Are you going to have to keep feeding it examples? And I think that what you're looking at is, yeah, you're going to need a system that not just has a much more holistic grasp of human language as a whole, but is also able to evolve with language as human usage changes. Because you can, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, slang phrases that look ridiculously offensive if you, you know, take them out of context.
Yes.
I mean, even the phrase, I think you're being racist, is 70% toxic.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, this seems barely better than just kind of whitelisting or blacklisting particular words. I mean, there have been other attempts at this before. How does perspective compare?
It's hard to say. I mean, someone would really need to do pairwise comparisons. Certainly, the technology does not seem, you know, so much better than keyword flagging. It has the ability to weed out things, to weed out issues where, you know, perhaps one issue of race is not as bad as another. So it is more sophisticated than keyword flagging, but the additional sophistication also opens it up to be more vulnerable to say, okay, to either have false negatives where it thinks that the use of a bad word is okay when it's not, mm-hmm. like some races are inferior to others, or false positives where it thinks that the use of perfectly normal words, non-flag keywords, is actually bad, like the word garbage truck, for example. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't necessarily put garbage into a keyword file. So somehow I got trained to think that the word garbage was indeed toxic, but in many cases, it's not. So it is more powerful, but as far as accuracy goes, I think the jury's out. Someone would need to conduct pretty extensive tests.
Do you have a sense of how it could be improved?
Yes and no. I think that the best deployment strategy for it is in situations in which it will be trained on specific sites, and that you will have a specific model for a given site. I actually spoke with the New York Times, and they said they were having good luck using it, not necessarily to filter toxicity, but to find high-quality New York Times comments. In other words, they weren't looking for necessarily for particular intent on the part of their commenters. They were looking for comments that sort of met the New York Times bar of well-phrased, well-written, intelligent. And that sort of pattern matching is actually more feasible than detecting toxicity, because it's less a matter of intent and more a matter of, okay, you know, does this sort of have the look and feel of a particular comment. And machine learning is better at finding, you know, things that match look and feel rather than trying to identify whether a particular commenter is trying to, you know, be mean or be a jerk. Mm-hmm. I think that if you train it on more specific domains, I think there's a lot of room for it to be useful there. I think that ironically, the prospective API that they rolled out, where it was sort of a general detect toxicity in any situation, is actually one of the hardest cases. And I'm somewhat surprised that they rolled out their prototype in that format, because I think it shows it probably to its, you know, worst effects.
Yeah. David, thanks so much for your thoughts on this.
Thanks for having me.
David Auerbach is a former Google software engineer who now writes for the MIT Technology Review. And if you'd like to try out Perspective for yourself, we have a link to it up at cbc.ca/spark. In a way, it's not surprising artificial intelligence has trouble figuring out context. Even for us humans, who are skilled in nuances of language, telling when someone is trolling us online or when they're being sarcastic can be a tricky thing to do. Talk about technology as the great equalizer. Think, for example, of tech designed to help people with disabilities communicate. Assistive technologies are hailed in the headlines as a way to give voice to the voiceless. But what exactly do we mean by giving voice?
My name is Meryl Alper. I'm an assistant professor of communication studies at Northeastern University and a faculty associate at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. And I'm the author of Giving Voice, Mobile Communication, Disability, and Inequality.
In her book, Meryl looked at how children with developmental disabilities use tablets equipped with apps to communicate. The apps convert icons and text into synthetic speech. She spent time with those children and their families to find out how they thought about and used that assistive technology. What she found is that just handing someone a talking tablet did not in itself give them a voice.
What happens months later, years later, what happens like outside of just wanting to talk to somebody and they only ask questions about how great it's going, mm-hmm. and they don't actually stick around for the literally messy parts of technology use in people's homes, then that's to me like where the interesting story would start.
Meryl discovered that technology use is complicated and that the messy parts of it can often get in the way. So what's problematic about that kind of formulation of giving voice to the voiceless?
So it's a phrase that is related to technology in some ways and also has a broader meaning. So we can think about biblically, actually. There's, you know, proverb about speaking for the downtrodden when they can't, you know, speak for themselves. So there's one kind of level there. And even in journalism, Society for Professional Journalists' core value about, you know, kind of speaking truth to power, giving voice to the voiceless, there's a sort of idea about amplification of stories that might not otherwise get heard.
Okay.
And there's one way that's, you know, that can be a good thing, but at the same time, there's already an inherent position there of voicelessness being this static, essential quality, like the voiceless.
Right.
And that can reinforce these power dynamics at the same time, especially when the claim about disempowerment is automatically associated with people with disabilities. When the assumption is voicelessness of powerlessness, then you're already sort of presupposing the way that they move through the world. And especially when it comes to technology and disability. And there's this idea of, well, technology, you know, can be a fix and disability means something is broken. That nuance about technology doesn't necessarily always get applied to assistive technology.
So it sounds like, you know, we already have this kind of overall cultural tendency to see technology as this kind of deus ex machina that comes in and fixes stuff independent of the social context or independent of mm-hmm. politics. And we already have this tendency to see people with disabilities as, you know, not fully agents, or as you say, as, you know, there's something broken. So it's almost like those two things are coming together in a bit of a double whammy.
Yeah. And within the, you know, the technology itself, there is the, you know, the cultural context. You know, individuals with disabilities have themselves not only disability as part of who they are, but everybody has a racial background. Everyone has a linguistic background. Everyone has a class and a, you know, gender background that intersects and interweaves in different ways for each person. And not only within that, within like a disability, you know, label or a diagnosis. So in what ways are policies enacted for people to gain access to technology or not gain it?
Right. So you're arguing that technology that's designed to universally empower, quote unquote, the voiceless, can sometimes reinforce inequality. So how does that happen?
Yeah. So a couple of ways, and I don't necessarily, isn't necessarily intended for it to be that. I don't give any sort of malicious intent to the designers necessarily, but the ways in which ideas, for example, about the kinds of voices that come out of these machines, the synthetic voices themselves. I was looking at one particular app, the one that, after looking at studying families using a bunch of different devices, ended up that most people were, when they were using the iPad, using this one app. And the range of voices that one might be able to choose from are rather limited, depending on what kind of preference you might have for how it could talk. So out of the 24 synthetic voice options that were available, 16 of them were gendered male in some manner, and only 8 were gendered female. And then when you continue to break that down, of the 24, only 3 were denoted in some way to be for a non-white population. And I say 4, not anybody can use any kind of voice they want to come out of these machines, but 2 of them were explicitly bilingual voices that could speak in the Spanish version of this app and or the English one. And the other one had this categorization as the hip-hop male adult voice, which calls upon kind of problematic tropes about Black vernacular and cultural stereotypes.
Right.
And so when you talk then about, oh, these technologies give voice, and if you don't inspect further about, well, what's like the nature of the actual voice that comes out of it, well, then you're sort of blanketing over any of those kinds of problems at the same time.
Right. You wrote that some parents, quote, looked forward to a day when technology would provide a more seamless link between a child's inner thoughts and their speech. Mm-hmm. How do the parents that you studied tend to view this kind of assistive technology?
So I think they tend to view it uniformly as something that they were hopeful about,
okay.
that if they had the optimal set of resources, and I should say, like, all of these parents were involved and, you know, wanted the best for their kids. And when you operate on a level of, well, if we had all of the support services that we're supposed to be getting, then that would be great. If we had all of the teachers and all the therapists and paraprofessionals in the school working with my child in the optimal, if those all things are met, then yes. If the parent themselves has comfort with technology in general, if they're somebody who is cool with, you know, mixing around and experimenting and doing additional research on Google to when something goes wrong, to like fix it themselves, like in that optimal condition, yeah, then like they would also be able to support the kid. So, but I think parents also had an awareness of that there was these ideal sets of conditions and that that wasn't always how life measured up. And so maintaining sort of these two ideas in their heads of what the technology could do and what it was or was not doing in their day-to-day lives.
So in practical terms, assuming that people weren't in those optimal situations, how did the different uses kind of play out? Are there examples that you could give me of how the technology played different roles in different types of families?
Yeah. There was one family story that really sort of stuck with me as an example of really ingenuity. There's one family that I spent time with who parents were immigrants from Mexico. The dad had learned English, and so a lot of the interviewing was conducted with him. Anyway, so there was some, I'm in their living room, and I just feel like the living room also doubled as the parents' bedroom. And there wasn't a lot of money around, but they had invested in technology. It was something that they had valued because they wanted to see their children benefit educationally from it.
Sure.
So the dad pulls out this, like a Kindle Fire, a not iPad. And the daughter automatically, the daughter is, you know, minimally or non-speaking, but she gives a real like, ugh, toward looking at it.
Right.
But what they had done a year or so earlier was that they had downloaded this one app where instead of it being synthetic speech, it was digitized speech. So you could record phrases, words, and press a button and have it output that. And so what the dad had done was have the girl's older sister record phrases like cookies or I want more bacon. And the dad said, oh, you know, it sounded like, you know, her younger sister, because it was her older sister. It had emotion. It had feeling. Mm. It sounded like how we wanted it to sound. And that was sort of on their own independently, had tried to find something that would, you know, help their daughter communicate. But once the school had done its evaluation, its recommendation about what kind of system that the girl should be using and that the school would support while she was in her classroom was the iPad and this other app. The voice options on that other app and the way that it sounded to the dad, at least, was sort of robotic and cold and didn't have the same emotion as sort of her flesh and blood recorded voice. But and so the dad had this real melancholy of they say it's going to help her, but I already know that she's not as enthusiastic about using this because it doesn't sound like how our family sounds. Mm-hmm. So there was this trade-off here between a really elegant change that they had done. What they valued a lot was having their daughter communicate in a way that was culturally appropriate. Mm-hmm. And the school had prioritized either because they had discounts on buying iPads in bulk and then this app in bulk, whether because, you know, people were trained there on how to use this app effectively with kids. Whatever the sort of reasons were, they were not the same motivations that the family had.
Right.
So there's still something to be said about what happens in the actual space, the home environment. And that's also a bigger question about bridging some of these out of school, in school divides in education. You know, what goes on at school, does it get translated at home? What goes on at home, does it end up benefiting kids at school? Like that's a much broader conversation. And this brings some of this at that level. And I think that a reflection upon other people's values around technology being different and how one's, you know, class background can influence that is needed as well.
So there's this idea that we've talked about that technology is somehow fixing, in quotation marks, people with disabilities. How do you think we can get beyond that way of thinking?
So I think the first part is to center the voices of individuals with disabilities in the conversations about what technology does and doesn't do for them and the kinds of innovations that they make or they make do with in how they experience technology. For more people with disabilities to be themselves involved in policy decisions, in technology development, for individuals with disabilities to be at the table when decisions about synthetic speech are being made, for example. But I think that the real key is to center those voices truly, not to give voice, but to truly center the voices of people with disabilities in conversations about them.
Meryl, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Meryl Alper is an assistant professor of communication studies at Northeastern University and the author of Giving Voice, Mobile Communication, Disability, and Inequality. Still ahead on Spark, it's increasingly normal to have cute, helpful personal assistants around, from Siri on your phone to the Amazon Echo in the corner of the room. So why not build your own? Meet Pico, the adorable robot that talks in GIFs. And new technology is making it easier to have a flatter workforce. People can communicate peer-to-peer, collaborate remotely, and share ideas, information, and company vision. So is it time to give the CEO the boot? That's coming up when Spark continues.
Support for this podcast comes from Choose.ca. You're listening to this podcast through CBC.ca, not .com.ca. You see, some of Canada's best and biggest brands choose.ca to represent themselves online. It's the only web address that means you're 100% Canadian. And 78% of Canadians prefer to support Canadian businesses on the internet. Get your .ca web address at www.choose.ca.
I'm Nora Young. This is Spark from your pals at CBC Radio. Do you have a guitar gathering dust in a corner of your house somewhere? Personally, I have a flute that I have not played since grade 9 band, but it's still lying around my home. Some people have it, and some people just don't when it comes to music, right? Well, it may be time to trade that instrument in for an app. Spark contributor Ben Shannon came to us recently with this simple question. Now that music-making technology is so advanced, can it finally free the musician in all of us?
Oh my gosh, I'm playing guitar. How is this even possible? I don't know how to play guitar. Have you ever had that dream? You know, the one where instead of quitting, you kept taking cello, violin, trumpet, or whatever musical instrument you were taking when you were a kid. The dream where you can make music. I had that dream. I was fortunate to have some musical training in my youth. A little piano here, a little cello there. But in all honesty, I've never really mastered an instrument. That's why I've always tried to offset my lack of musical skill with technology. My closet is brimming with synthesizers, samplers, and sequencers. Heck, if it promised to make music making easier, I bought it. But for all its promise, music technology wasn't really ever all that helpful. My time probably would have been better spent practicing the old-fashioned way. The good news is, music tech has come a long way in the last couple of years, and it may finally be ready for a serious second look. Developers are really aiming to put music in the hands of novices. But with the right tech, can anyone make music? I mean, music that truly captures the song in their hearts? With just a smartphone? Well, I wanted to find out.
My name is Althea Manassan. I am a trending producer here at CBC Radio.
Have you ever made music professionally or?
No. Like, I learned how to play the clarinet in grade 4 and 5. I've been interested in my whole life, but I've never stuck with any sort of instrument to be really good at it.
Despite your lack of musical training.
Mm-hmm.
You've dreamed of making music?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I asked you a couple days ago to pick out a song that you like.
I thought of a bunch of songs, but maybe I'll go with I'll Be There, but the cover version by Mariah Carey.
Okay. We're going to analyze the song.
Okay.
We're just going to use a free app to find out what key it's in.
Okay.
And you're going to write a song in that same key.
Okay. I'm excited.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I figured we should talk to a real music tech specialist to find out what Althea's chances of success actually are.
My name's Nick Batt, and I'm editor of sonicstate.com, which is a music technology website.
And you've been involved in music technology for a very long time, right, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I started my working in music, must have been, gosh, 86, something like that, 1986.
How would you say music technology has changed since then?
Well, I think it's changed enormously, but I mean, the complexity's not necessarily changed. The solutions have become much more affordable and much more widespread. So it's more accessible in a really big way. So you end up, you know, people can get into it for much less outlay and don't have to have a degree in music technology to kind of get started. Just some enthusiasm, I guess.
What do you think about the music creation apps that are coming out right now?
Some are great. I prefer the stuff that doesn't just say, hey, you don't have to have any skills to create great music. And I disagree with that. I think you do, and you should. I mean, because if everybody could do it, then it devalues everything. I don't think there's anything wrong with simplicity. I think what the issue I have is when simplicity is seen as replacing a skill of any kind, you know, of any kind. Skill is irrelevant, and I think skill isn't irrelevant.
We've given a producer here some iPhone apps, and we've asked her to try and make a song, but she has minimal musical training. What do you think her chances are?
Well, it depends whether she's got a good idea for a song, because if you have a good idea for a song, then you can make it work. If you've got no idea what you want to do and you're just going to fumble around, as I said before, without any direction to go in, then it's going to be hard. You know, it's not necessarily the inability to play the notes you mean as much as it is to come up with a coherent idea or a strength of idea. You know, and that's the beauty of all of this, isn't it? I mean, if she turns out to be very creative and can write, you know, a short ditty or maybe a series of musical ideas that hang together, then her chances are good.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, Nick.
Cheers then. Bye-bye. Yep.
So, Althea, it's been 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
How was your music-making experience?
It was actually a lot of fun.
That's good.
Yeah.
How many songs did you write?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't call them songs yet.
That was my next question, actually, was would you call them songs?
No, because when I think of a song, I think of it has verses and a chorus. But mine is really just loops. One of them, I was able to build more complicated parts to the song.
Yep.
But it's still really just like a chorus over and over.
Were you able to make something that you're proud of?
Yeah, I think so. I say that not having had other people listen to it yet. From where I was at the beginning to where I got, yes, I am proud of what I made.
So were the apps too easy or too hard overall?
I think they are, the learning curve was not as steep as I thought it would be once I got into it. It was pretty easy.
Do you think that using these has given you any confidence to continue doing this?
Yeah, I think so. Again, like, it'd be better if I knew a little bit more about music and how to write songs, like more the theory behind it. But like, it's a really cool tool, you know, for someone who doesn't really play musical instruments. It's a way to play with sounds and move things around really easily.
Do you think you will keep making music with this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Are you wondering how Althea did? All the music you've been hearing, including the track playing right now, it's hers. It's miles better than what I was expecting.
Hey!
So what's the real musical value of these apps? Well, in music, as with so many things in life, there are no real shortcuts. To become an expert, it simply takes years and years of practice. And since these apps are intentionally stripped down, they're probably just not deep enough to hold someone's interest for that long. I have no doubt we'll eventually see a virtuoso like Jimi Hendrix or Miles Davis rocking a touch interface, but it'll have to be loaded with more robust programs than these. So, not quite pro quality yet. But I think it doesn't matter. What's great about these programs is they're a gateway to music. With minimal practice, quality results just flow forth. And that positive reinforcement will undoubtedly encourage people to keep playing and practicing. In a way, these simple music-making apps remind me of my daughter's toy piano. It's locked to a simple C major scale. So she can never play a wrong note. But then, that's the point. It's positive reinforcement that will encourage people to keep playing and practicing and chasing their dreams. For Spark, I'm Ben Shannon.
If you want to try out some of these tools for yourself, we have links to a bunch of them up at our website, cbc.ca/spark. I'm Nora Young. This is Spark from CBC Radio. Can we talk bot for a moment? Lately, I've been thinking that A baby born in Canada this year might be the first to grow up where having a smart assistant around the house is a perfectly ordinary part of daily life. I mean, right now, that's likely to be something like Alexa, the voice-activated assistant for the Amazon Echo. But developments in AI and robotics are happening so quickly, home robots might soon be as familiar as Saturday morning cartoons. Like, consider this guy. That's Pico. It's a little robot that sits on your desk. You can see a video of him up at cbc.ca/spark right now. Pico moves its little body around, it can play music for you, entertain you, turn the lights off. It was built by this guy.
I'm Abhishek Singh, and I created Pico.
Yep, he made it himself for his thesis at NYU. Oh, and Pico has one little quirk. It's
the first and only robot in the world who responds entirely through GIFs, or GIFs, depending on how you like to phrase it.
And does Pico have a perspective on whether it's GIF or JIF?
Well, the last time I asked him, he said it was GIF. I wasn't too happy. He turned on his master extremely soon. I mean, he calls it GIF. I call it JIF. I'll see if I can reprogram him to correct him.
Abhishek thinks of Pico as
the love child of Amazon Echo and your favorite Disney character. I would say he's cute. He's small. He stands roughly at 8 inches high. And he's extremely relatable and extremely approachable. He has a screen on his face. He has a soft exoskeleton, which allows him to like bend and move in different ways. Mm-hmm. And he has these cute little glasses that he wears at all points of time.
Pico's design is even open source, so you can make your own. Well, you can if you're a technical person and really committed. But still, it's surprising how everyday it all seems. Well, except for the GIFs.
So that was a design decision that I made on purpose. He doesn't talk. He does augment his vocabulary or his communication of sorts through robotic beeps or like little kind of sounds which add to his entire expression. But what I would say is GIFs are his core form of expression. And also what is very important to me is not non-verbal communication. So he can bend, twist, and move in different ways. And that also coincides with the type of information or expression he's trying to emote.
So who do you imagine is the ideal user of Pico?
I designed him primarily keeping myself in mind. And I know like there are a lot of people like me who spend really large amounts of time in front of the computer all day.
Yes.
And sometimes need like a little help, a little entertainment, and also a little help with work to kind of get through the day.
So why did you want to create Pico?
The main reason I wanted to create Pico, I wanted to see if I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Following that, I've always been fascinated with robots kind of personally. And I've always kind of wanted to build one. And at the same time, my three kind of areas of interest, they're like animated GIFs,
mm-hmm.
Animated movies, and building things by hand. So Pico somehow was at the intersection of these three. I mean, they are seemingly disparate fields, but they do say kind of like creativity exists at the intersection of like seemingly disparate fields. It kind of worked out.
That's quite the perfect Venn diagram you have going
on
there.
Exactly. It's
Pico
the little sweet spot right in the center of that Venn diagram.
And so why does he communicate with GIFs?
GIFs have kind of become this universal language of expression across the internet. And they're capable, like in an extremely kind of short little animated loop, of being able to communicate anything from expression to emotion to information. I had been like researching kind of robotics a lot, and the entire conversation around social robotics kind of revolved around the fact that, how do we allow these robots to become more relatable and approachable,
mm-hmm.
and how do we allow them to kind of communicate expression and emotion. And then you see these extremely complex makeups in which they're trying to recreate facial human expressions with a series of motors embedded and like all those kinds of things. GIFs are being used to communicate so much these days in every message, every text, and in every form of internet medium. It would be cool to see a marriage of the two and see what the result looks like.
Mm-hmm. So without getting too technical, can mm-hmm. we look under the hood a little bit? How did you actually go about building this?
The exoskeleton, which is the soft exoskeleton, is actually just a spandex, which allows him to like bend and move.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of him, I first 3D modeled, and after that, I 3D printed. So I had simulated all his connections, the entire assembly on a computer before 3D printing it out of there. His brains, Pico's brains, is essentially a Raspberry Pi 3.
Okay.
And all the sensing and all the movement is then controlled by servos, which are actuated using Arduinos.
What's the voice recognition component there?
I built 4 custom microphones, which are placed 2 facing forward and 2 in essentially what are his ears. That allows him to kind of listen in.
Mm-hmm.
And all the processing is then done on the Raspberry Pi.
Okay. Beyond, you know, the fun of having a little robot on your desk, mm-hmm. can we talk a little bit more about the human-robot interaction aspect here? What are you working on there?
I designed Pico essentially around the idea of having a personality. Like, I want every interaction that you have with him to create some sort of element of delight or some sort of element of surprise. Currently, what I'm working on is obviously refining the interactions that you have with him, but also at the same time trying to figure out how can I give him like more of a personality? How can I give him a personality that essentially kind of evolves depending on how you interact with him?
But this is an interesting thing. I mean, beyond the specifics of Pico himself, mm-hmm. when we're interacting with robots or AI, this is a pretty subtle thing of how much personality we want and how much just straight up information delivery we want. You know, if I'm in a bad mood, maybe I don't want Siri to be giving me joke answers. I just want Siri to be giving me actual answers. Exactly. How do you think we can come to sort of have that kind of nuance over how our AI communicates with us?
It's kind of a difficult thing to answer, but that's what I'm kind of working on, is that can he detect my tone? Can mm-hmm. he detect the mood I'm in? Can he detect what time of the day I'm interacting with him? Is it during a meeting? Is it during work? Or is it during kind of my leisure time? And can he kind of create his message or his response based on those inputs?
Right. I guess you could imagine a scenario where maybe he has calendar integration in some sense.
Exactly.
If it knows that you're at work, then maybe it shouldn't be.
Yes.
And those using are kind swear of, words or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And those are kind of integrations that I'm already working on, is essentially connect him to your other devices, to your smart devices, to your phone, to your computer, to your calendar, so that he's kind of aware of what you're doing and where you're kind of doing it, and he can tailor his responses accordingly.
So I know that Pico doesn't rely on Amazon Echo, but I know that mm-hmm. there are examples of robots that are built on top of that
yes.
technology. So as a person who's interested in hardware, do you have thoughts on that?
The detection of the keyword Pico, that happens completely offline.
Okay.
And that was a personal decision because there are a lot of privacy concerns around your audio possibly being continuously streamed up to the cloud. Pico doesn't stream anything up to the cloud. Mm-hmm. till he hears his own name. And following that, currently he uses the Google Cloud Speech API to stream the rest of the command,
okay.
Convert it to text, and then get some kind of meaning out of it. Alexa is also an extremely good service that I could possibly integrate into him. I guess that would be an option that I would like to leave customizable so that the user can decide whether they want to use their Google service as the backend or whether they want to use the Alexa service as the backend.
So you created Pico for your thesis at NYU at the Tisch School, but now, yes. as I understand, you have an unrelated startup. So what continues to give you this passion around this project?
For me, the thing that drives me most is, I guess, learning. I've learned so much from this project, and I continue to learn so much from all the different projects that I take. I enjoy putting things together, which bring in like these disparate fields and disparate skill sets together, because that's where I feel the most creative outputs do tend to happen. My startup's unrelated. Pico is completely unrelated, but perhaps at some stage in the future, you will see an intersection of those two skill sets.
Another great Venn diagram in the waiting
exactly,
in the future.
Exactly. I just have to figure out where that sweet spot is.
Yeah. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Abhishek Singh is the creator of Pico the Robot. And like I said, the plans are available open source if you want to make your own Pico. It is pretty technical, but you know, a bot's reach should exceed its grasp. Find it at cbc.ca/spark. Pico may not be for everyone to build, but it does point to a few trends we're seeing more of. Voice-activated technologies and personal assistants that are with you all the time and learn from being around you. Expect to see a lot more on both those fronts. What does it take to be a chief executive officer? New research out of Duke University suggests having a look of competence, not necessarily competence itself, is vitally important to becoming a CEO. And thanks to good old-fashioned sexism, perhaps it's no surprise that what's deemed a reassuring look is most often white, middle-aged, and male. After all, only 4% of CEOs in the Fortune 500 are women. But just how important is it to have a CEO anyway? 4 years ago, Crisp, a Swedish software consulting firm, said, not so much. So they got rid of their CEO. And they're not the only ones. A number of companies have been turning towards non-hierarchical, leaderless structures.
My name is Jimmy Janlien.
Jimmy is a consultant at Crisp in Stockholm. So how did their decision to stop having a CEO come about?
It may sound dramatic, but it wasn't for us. We've been kind of having a self-organizing structure all along. We had the habit of electing a new CIO every second year.
Mm-hmm.
But then we tried out the thought experiment. What if we actually elected no one? What impact would that have? So on the conference 4 years ago, where we kind of discussed the future of our company together, so we tried this out, and there was a small working group, including the CEO,
mm-hmm.
who explored what would it mean? What task is the person doing today? What tasks could others do? What responsibilities were there? And we figured out that there was nothing blocking us. And everyone was more excited because it actually distributed ownership and ability to influence to more people. So once that group presented it by the end of the day at the conference, it was a very simple vote.
Hmm. So you say that you already had this kind of distributed work structure. Do you think that's part of what made it work in the sense that you were already kind of on the on-ramp to doing that?
Yeah, probably. It was not a scary move for us. In essence, the CEO had more been kind of like a public ambassador in some essence.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, many of us are that anyway. Like I'm being a public ambassador now.
So there are about 40 of you working there. How does the staff go about making big decisions without a CEO?
So we're a consultant company. So this is our home, so to speak, which means that we need to take care of it together. Everyone is free to make any kind of decision at any moment in time if they feel they have enough input, or if the decision is small enough, for example, buying a popcorn machine for the office, just do it. But if you're talking about maybe extending the size of our office, we do a lot of training, so we have training facilities. That's obviously a decision that would impact the economy of the whole company. So that's a decision that needs to be made by everyone. And to do that, we have two big yearly conferences where we all get together, where we raise the discussions we want to have and we propose new decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these decisions come through, others flunk and fail and doesn't come through.
And so you still have a board, though, that's made up of people who work at Crisp?
That's true. And at once a year, at one of these bi-yearly conferences, we elect a new board. And those four people, from a legal perspective, they are the ones responsible for making sure that we have our finances in check.
Okay.
We rely on them to keep track on our two things, our economy. But most importantly, we have something called the happiness index. So we don't measure success in profit for Crisp. We measure success how happy the members of Crisp are. We have a spreadsheet where we frequently fill out how happy we are about things. And if those numbers drop, the board are expected to contact that person and see what's wrong.
So you've been doing this for about 4 years now. What are some of the advantages you found of not having a CEO?
Things move faster. There's more people who has the authority or feel the responsibility to make decisions when needed to. It also have distributed the sense of ownership. So more people feel committed to making this place we call home work better.
Any disadvantages? Any times when you've thought we need to get the CEO back in here?
Not so far, but a key reason was why this works for us, because we're not a profit-maximizing company. We're a home for consultants. So our goal, our purpose is to build a nice home for ourselves and to maximize how well people enjoy being members of Crisp and how much they learn. I would guess if we, for example, would sell a product or have external stakeholders, we would probably need to react faster in some situations.
So this is an interesting point. I mean, how generalizable do you think this is? How many kinds of companies or businesses could work off of your model?
I think most companies could be heavily inspired by it to question what kind of work is the top management doing and what kind of responsibilities are they living up to. And see if that could be distributed or turned into teamwork activities instead to allow more people to feel that they have a chance to influence. Because in my experience, the ability to be responsible and to influence is a thing that deeply motivates people.
Hmm. But isn't there a danger of sort of management by committee, you know, that if you have to come to a consensus on things, you don't have the option of one person to sort of decisively making a decision?
Yes, in many situations and many businesses, a non-decision is not okay. So then if we would end up there, we actually do have fallback plans. So when we vote on things, we usually go for consent. But in some situations, that's not okay. We actually need to choose between A, B, or C. So if we fail to agree, we fall back on a democratic voting, which means the majority wins. For us, that's a failure because that means that some people lose.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we're forced to do that. And if that ultimately fails, then it falls to the steering group. But we have not had this situation so far. So it's a hypothetical problem for us.
Right. This seems to be happening more and more. We've covered kind of no-boss workplaces on the show before. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is happening now?
I think more and more companies are both have the courage to experiment, but also from different movements such as Agile and Lean. There are a lot of other really exciting new structures emerging, such as Holacracy and Sociocracy, which are based on different kinds of teams having different kinds of authority or responsibilities. It has slowly been proven that not every decision has to be run through a hierarchy of power. Actually having a distributed system for distributed governance, allowing the people closer to the problem or the work to make the decisions they need to make has proven to be more efficient and increased motivation in the staff, which in turn increases the quality of the work itself.
Mm-hmm. So what does the future hold for your company? Are you hoping it'll grow or are things about to fall apart any second?
No, it's not happily not falling apart any second at all. We're growing stronger, we're growing older, we're gradually becoming more and more people. Since we don't have a pointed leader that can show us the way, the future is always something that emerges for us. So we take small step by step and we have new exciting experiments going on internally. We do have made our model public. So we have open sourced our model and we have seen other startups being inspired by this all over the world. We have a hard time agreeing upon a future path. So we are always discovering what our next move is.
Jimmy, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Jimmy Lanyin is a consultant at Swedish consulting firm Crisp. We have a link to their open source model on our website, cbc.ca/spark. Beyond getting rid of the CEO, the less hierarchical workplace has really been taking off more generally. And while it's too early to say anything definitive, there have been some mixed results. Companies like DPR Construction and WL Gore, the Gore-Tex people, run their organizations without a traditional CEO. Though they do have leaders, the Gore folks have had a flattened work structure since 1958. Morningstar, the world's largest tomato processing company, has no managers. Other attempts at a flatter work structure have been less positive. Online shoe retailer Zappos has experimented with Holacracy, which Jimmy mentioned. It's a form of self-management that involves people working like a computer operating system. And no, I don't know what that means either. Zappos seems to be having trouble settling into the system and employee turnover has become a problem. Back in 2013, we interviewed Ryan Carson from the online education company Treehouse. Back then, they'd recently eliminated all the bosses, but now they've had to switch back to a conventional management structure. Carson has said it was fine when the company was small, but it became a problem when they grew to over 100 employees. Workers felt unsupported, and there were problems with accountability. Crisp's experience may well be different given that their focus is not on becoming a bigger company and the employees are consultants with a high degree of independence. So maybe a flat workplace most often works best in small organizations with autonomous employees. That's it for Spark this time around. The show is made by
Michelle Parisi,
Kent Hoffman,
Adam Killick,
Rachel Matlow,
and me, Nora Young, and by
David Auerbach,
Meryl Alper,
Ben Shannon,
Abhishek Singh,
and
Jimmy Jamlian.
Find us on Facebook and Twitter for tech news and behind-the-scenes info on Spark, or just to say hi to us. We like you. We are Spark CBC, and I'm Nora 3000. If you want to listen to Spark whenever you want, get the free podcast. Just go to cbc.ca/spark and click on podcast, or subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. Or take the new CBC Radio app for a spin. Listen live or on demand. It's free for Android or iOS. I'm Nora Young. Until next time, be the best boss of your own life.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.